This is the Frogcast.
Welcome to this special edition of the Frogcast as we have been previewing the Alamo Bowl with the Frogs taking on the Oregon Ducks. On a happenstance, I reached out to Dan Rubenstein, who is one of the hosts of the Solid Verbal podcast. If you don't listen to it, you need to. Probably the most downloaded college football podcast that is out there. Also works for SB Nation, which is the mothership of Frogs of War, which I know a lot of folks listen to and are always keeping up with the Frogs on that front. And I reached out and he said, sure, I'd love to come on here and talk about TCU and talk about Oregon. Not only does he know a lot about college football, Dan is an Oregon fan, so we will do some good nature ribbing of him on that. Dan, welcome to our show.
You can do any sort of nature ribbing if you'd like, because there's a lot to rib about me and my fandom. But thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on. I think you got all of my pertinent information correct, so we're great.
Perfect. Perfect. I wanted to give like a 30-second plug to your podcast because many years ago I was commuting back and forth from Iowa to Chicago, and the only podcast worth listening to that I knew of was on Wednesdays when Beano Cook was on with Ivan Mizell.
Sure.
And then I stumbled onto you guys doing the Solid Verbal, and it is, you know, God bless Beano. After he passed away, you guys jumped to the top and have stayed there, and nothing other than this podcast can remove you. So.
Oh, that's far too kind of you to say. And I recognize your name and Twitter handle, and I have for a long time. So it's one of those things where there's a weird digital college football community, and I'm glad that we digitally know each other.
Well, that is true. I have followed along and tweeted and retweeted and actually appreciate your replies. And a journalist that is willing to actually talk to the common man, I do actually appreciate that. So
great.
We are going to dig into the bowl here right away and get into TCU and Oregon. Daniel, why don't you take it away?
Hey, Dan. Thanks for getting on the show with us.
Sure.
Down here, you know, we know, of course, all about TCU and the Big 12, but for whatever reason, you know, late-night games for us and things like that, our audience probably doesn't know a whole lot about Oregon, so why don't you give us a rundown of the 2015 Ducks?
So it's been a weird road this season, and it's at the end of the season, by the end of the season, by November, Oregon looked like the team, the Ducks of old. And, you know, people are used to seeing the big offenses, the flashy uniforms, the generally very good to excellent Heisman-winning quarterbacks. And by the end of the year, it certainly a lot it looked familiar. This season was sort of defined by Vernon Adams, the FCS quarterback transfer from Eastern Washington, coming in almost immediately, getting hurt. And then went back after his injury, after a couple of Oregon losses that were somewhat avoidable. Oregon looked like the Oregon of old, and he eventually became the most efficient quarterback in the country. But this was all sort of happening alongside a defense that was replacing pretty much its entire secondary and struggled pretty much all season long, linebackers and secondary-wise. And a lot of criticism fell on Don Pelham, the defensive coordinator, some of it correctly and some of it perhaps a little bit too much considering what he was dealing with. But all in all, Oregon has won six straight. The offensive line is experienced in front of Vernon Adams. The receivers are incredibly deep. Royce Freeman is in the backfield, and he ran on a Heisman level, put up better numbers than a couple of other top running backs in the country. So Oregon is quite strong at the moment on offense with Vernon Adams throwing a really great deep ball. And defensively, a lot of questions. They give up a lot of big plays. They make a lot of mental errors, but also may have the best defensive lineman in the country, if not for Joey Bosa, perhaps. But DeForest Buckner is a defensive end in Oregon's 3-4 system, and he has become pretty much unblockable and would not surprise a lot of people if he went sort of top five, top seven in the NFL draft. So all in all, a successful rebuilding year that ends up with Oregon in the top 15. But the Rose Bowl is about 5 seconds away, so that sort of also receives the consternation of some Duck fans.
Ah, okay. All right. And based on that and what we know about TCU and everything, that sounds to me like this is going to be the best matchup that it's not a playoff game. And if I was really being a homer, I'd say it's probably even better than one of the playoff games. So how do you see TCU matching up against Oregon?
I think it's a great matchup for TCU. I think there's a lot to like if you're a Horned Frog fan, short of the obvious Josh Doctson injury, sort of changing a little bit of what TCU's offense look like, sort of shortens the field a little bit. But I know TCU fans are very excited for some of their younger offensive skill guys. It's got its Turpin, right? Kevontae
yes,
Turpin?
Kevontae
I don't
Turpin.
Want to get that wrong.
Yeah, but he had two Power 5 offers, and he just tore it up all year.
Yeah, he seems to be completely electric and one of those guys that sort of makes a name for himself in bowl season going into next year as somebody to watch out for as a playmaker. So I think those guys should scare Oregon. Aaron Green quietly had a very nice back half of the season, and Oregon hasn't been the most consistent against the run. So there's a lot of reasons to think that TCU will be able to move the ball consistently. Oregon gets healthier on defense, which is nice. I'm sure the time off has been very nice for TCU players on the mend. But I would say if you are at all scared of the deep pass and what Oklahoma State did to TCU a few weeks ago, if that's a lingering fear of TCU fans, I'd continue to be worried because Oregon goes very deep at receiver, both roster-wise and field-wise, and Vernon Adams is good at buying time and throwing deep. But at the same time, I think TCU defensively will be able to, if they're able to wrap up, they should be pretty good in getting into Oregon's backfield at times. The Oregon offensive line is good, but a little bit leaky. So I think you're absolutely right. This matchup outside of the playoff, and maybe even including the sort of dryness of Alabama, Michigan State, potentially, I think it's one of the best, if not the best, behind Oklahoma Clemson in terms of this is going to be an entertaining TV show. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, I agree. As soon as everybody kind of figured that this was going to be the bowl matchup, I was as excited as can be for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is this is going to be a game everybody and their cousin is going to want to watch, and I am looking forward to it. You know, just kind of looking back at 2014 as a Duck fan, how do you compare and contrast what the team was able to do last year to this year? And, you know, this might be heresy to some Oregon fans. Does Vernon Adams touch Mariota when he was not hurt?
Yeah, he does. I mean, numbers-wise, they're pretty similar. And the deep ball that he throws, he releases it very quickly, and there's a certain fearlessness about him. He throws with incredible touch. The release is incredibly quick. And that specific throw, looking downfield, it might be a talent that Vernon Adams has a little bit better than Marcus Mariota. He doesn't have the calm. He doesn't have the thing that should calm TCU fans a little bit is Marcus Mariota is an incredible runner. He is a long strider. He makes up yards quickly, and he's got great bursts. Vernon Adams is not a runner. He's elusive in the backfield, and he buys himself time. He's very difficult to bring down at 5'10", 5'11". But he is not what Mariota was as a complete athlete. But yeah, in terms of understanding Oregon's offense with such little time in the actual offense to learn, Vernon Adams has a lot of the lethal attributes that Mariota did, just not the overall package, but no, he's a reminder of it. He's accurate. He throws the ball down the field really well. And, he's got a great sense.
Yeah. We've kind of dubbed this the what if bowl. Cause I think if Doctson and Boykin did not get hurt, I think we could have beat Oklahoma, could have been 11-1 and possibly in the playoff. And I know Oregon fans probably have a similar story of what injuries created, like you said, a few seconds away from the Rose Bowl and a few seconds more away from the playoff. So you're going to see two playoff caliber teams that are going to be able to take it on in the Alamo Bowl.
Yeah, absolutely. I was yelling at my screen when I saw the 2-point conversion attempt and Oklahoma go completely empty at linebacker. And I just started yelling. I remember this specifically. And I forget the TCU backups quarterback's name. It wasn't Bram. It was the other guy.
Yeah, no, it was Kohlhausen.
Bram. Oh, it was.
Kohlhausen.
And
yes.
I was just like, draw, please. Because it was there, and I don't know if you guys had that same reaction, but it killed me.
Well, I saw that, but I also know he's slow, and I don't think he would have made it. You know, I mean, that whole second half is a summary of our experience of this season, which is it is absolutely pure guts that got us to where we are. And while sure. I would give anything to have made that extra point, this year's team does not touch last year's team. So
fair, totally. Fair.
Yeah, yeah. We had a consensus among our team. We made the right call. We went for it, and we didn't get it, but we're okay with going for it because we beat Baylor the next week, and it was worth it all.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love that call. I love aggression. I love, you know, let's win it on the 2-yard line, on the, you know, it's on the door. I'm knocking on the door. It's right there, and it's I like balls. It's great.
Yeah, dang right. Dang right. It's the cliche, but if you'd have told us without Boykin and Doxson, we were one play away from beating Oklahoma and being in a position to fight for a top four spot, we'd have been just fine with that.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, we want to pivot here. We want to get an outsider's perspective on both. You know, we'll do it one at a time. When somebody that knows college football, but you know, is a Pac-12 fan, is a Big Ten fan, hears about TCU, what is the national perception of TCU in terms of their standing in the eyes of people that don't, you know, hate TCU because we have to play them once a year?
I would say TCU has an overwhelmingly positive reputation outside of Fort Worth, outside of the Lone Star State. There hasn't been too much in the way of controversy. They've been fun to watch. They've been a team that you enjoy watching if you have no rooting interest, because the Trevon Boykin story and his ability from where he was as a quarterback behind Pahal and then coming in and really embracing and mastering the Meacham Cumbie offense, that's a fun thing to watch. It's wide open. You know, there's sort of recognizable defensive players. I think TCU rightfully had the defensive reputation for a long time because of Gary Patterson's background and that sort of nasty 4-2-5 when it's operating at its ceiling. But TCU in general, they win a Rose Bowl over Wisconsin, so you have that cred that they can win that big one even coming out of the Mountain West. And then coming to the Big 12, even though a couple of years have been sort of up and down, you see that the transition, and there were all sorts of teams that were making the move up, obviously with Utah to the Pac-12, West Virginia moving to a new Power 5 conference in the Big 12, and Colorado moving to their own new conference. There were some struggles and adjustments to new conference play, but TCU has been the sort of case study for how it can sort of seamlessly work. And I don't remember where I mentioned this, all of the Fox Sports shots of the cheerleaders in the Fiesta Bowl, I believe, that didn't hurt TCU's reputation either. So I think we're talking about a net positive here.
Yeah, yeah, we've been known for that for a long time, and it's good.
Yes, yes, we have. What is it? Daniel probably knows this as well as I do. I think it's like 60-40 female-male, or 65-35 female-male on campus. I mean, like that is they send you like a one-page brochure if you're a guy and are interested in TCU.
Oh, nice. Actually, you know what I do know? What else I know? Because I've been friends with, here comes a name drop if you guys are ready. I've been friends with Kaylee Hartung for a while from ESPN, and she used to work for Bob Schieffer, who I believe
yeah.
is cool. an enormous Horned Frog.
Yes, he
so
is.
I know that.
Schieffer School of Journalism. Yes.
Yeah, so that is something else, at least I know, and have in my back pocket for a TCU reference.
Yeah, that'll get you a long way.
And isn't it also the golf writer, Dan Jenkins?
Dan Jenkins,
oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Dan Jenkins, so, yeah. When people say you guys won your national championships when nobody remembers, we're like, Dan Jenkins was in the stadium for both of us.
Of course he was.
Yeah, he remembers Davey O'Brien. He remembers Sammy Ball.
Yeah, so there's a great sports and general journalism connection. So
well,
I like
daughter Sally Jenkins writes for the Washington
yes,
Post.
Yes, yeah, obviously, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody knows somebody that knows somebody that loves TCU, and we're included in that. But I want to pivot to just like the crappy politics of college mm-hmm. football, and I call it that. It is crap politics. We have a massive inferiority complex in the Big 12. In
sure.
terms of, oh my gosh, we don't have a playoff game, because I can't remember who first said that, but in 2006, nobody in the Big Ten was saying the Big Ten shouldn't be in the title because they don't have a title game. But here we are now as the only conference without a title game. I'm a firm believer that Oklahoma could win it all, and also if Stanford had one loss, Oklahoma would not be in the playoff.
Sure.
And I just think that's fact. So what is the national perception of the Big 12? And if you were commissioner for a day and had four shots of bourbon in you, what would you do?
The perception, I think, is probably what you think it is, in that, you know, the backloaded schedules hurt the conference, and that people aren't talking as much about big wins early on in the season. Give your teams an opportunity to not only build a resume, but just build awareness. And TCU, I think, is scheduled pretty well in the non-conference the next couple years. It's Arkansas and Ohio State.
Ohio State, Stanford, and Cal.
Yes. So that's great. That's the thing. And I saw, you know, the Big 12 scheduling is sort of evening out.
If we call that the Baylor rule.
The Baylor rule, evening out the bigger games over the course of the season. I think the big thing for the Big 12 is the fact that there isn't a recent year where you can point to a ton of depth. And it is very fun, and I'm sure inside the Big 12 as well, to just blame Texas. And that's fun, because Texas being down, even though it's been fun to sort of watch both, I'm sure, inside and outside the conference, you want to have that year where you can, and it's hard to just automatically say that a conference is deep, but to say they have a lot of decent teams. And that's what the Pac-12 had last year with the Pac-12 South. That's what the SEC West has, and that's what the SEC has built up over time, because it is, you know, perception does become reality when, yes, even though there's a non-conference slate, you're still talking about the product on the field that people see and the ability to point to, like, hey, we have, you know, six teams that are 8-4, 9-3, 10-2, whatever. And the fact that Texas isn't, the fact that West Virginia has faded these past couple of seasons, the fact that, you know, TCU Baylor sort of fizzled out this year because of injuries in terms of, oh, and the monsoon, obviously, in terms of attention for that game that everybody had circled before the season. So I think that, you know, in lieu of having the actual conference championship game with 10 teams, I think that's a big thing. Big non-conference victories early on, and just depth of decency, which I don't feel like, I mean, you know, Texas Tech's defense just sort of let them down all year long. Iowa State, and now they have a coaching transition. Maybe they're a little bit more respectable. Kansas is obviously known as just the worst, and Kansas State having a down year. So you just can't as a conference be like 1.8 good teams heavy, 2.3 good teams heavy. It needs to go deeper in order to sort of say, well, who is Oklahoma really beaten? Or who is TCU really beaten? Or who is Baylor really beaten? Because that sort of becomes the end of the sentence when talking about the Big 12. So, yeah, I think it is depth of decency.
So if something as simple as Memphis and Cincinnati kind of bumped everybody up one more win, and then you had eight games and you got to have one more cream puff, does that somehow send West Virginia was able to beat Kansas State to end the season? Does that make a 9-3 West Virginia better than an 8-4 West Virginia, an 8-4 Tech better than a 7-5 Tech?
Because it depends who they beat to get there, and you know, some big defining wins go a long way. The fact that, you know, Oklahoma State has this 70-50 whatever win over Texas Tech, it's great, but Oklahoma State has to build upon that. They beat TCU, but then they get killed in Bedlam. So it's one of those things where, you know, who's really good when you have these extremely uneven performances? And yeah, even if you add Memphis and Cincinnati, these are decent programs at the moment. They're decent programs. And to be able to do it all year long, to win a couple outside, and Oklahoma had the win over who they beat, Tennessee. Baylor didn't play anybody. TCU, you know, had the opportunity to go to Minnesota early on in the season. You know, wasn't the most impressive night, obviously, but Minnesota, again, is not the team you're going to point to in a resume scenario. But yeah, it really does make a difference what that final number is and how you got to that final number. It's, you want teams separating. You know, in the Pac-12, the way they did this was Stanford and Oregon separated themselves. And then last year, there were some early good wins for the Pac-12 South early on in the season, and they looked high level in their bowl games. And it was a complete season of a good amount of separation.
Well, yeah, I think our inferiority complex is probably half psychological and half real, and I think you just articulated the real very, very well. And
with that said, by the way, Oklahoma can beat Alabama.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes.
It's not to say that the top can't hang with anybody else's top.
Yeah.
So that'll be great for the Big 12 if that happens.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Well, one of the things I have followed for you guys at SB Nation, I think it's you and Ryan Nanny and a few other people that created one more award for college football, and it got left out of the award show down in Florida, which I was kind of frustrated by. Tell us about the Peisman Trophy.
The Peisman Trophy is quite simply a trophy. A lot of trophies, or most trophies, award players. This awards moments that happen to involve players. And that moment, we feel like, is the most universally beloved moment in college football. And that's a moment where a large gentleman, generally a lineman, finds himself with the ball in his hands, generally inexplicably or by happenstance, on defense, whether it's scoop and score, interception, some weird moment, or on offense, you know, in a design play at the goal line, or, you know, some sort of short yarded situation with a handoff or play action to a giant 400-pound Baylor tight end. It really is fun to see those who are not generally getting that glory and, you know, getting that poster moment, getting the ball, huffing and puffing, stiff arming, hurdling, diving in. That's just great. And even if you were watching TCU against Oklahoma, TCU, Baylor, whoever, like, there's a certain part of you, it's probably repressed, that you can appreciate Laquan McGowan and what he is able to do with the 400 pounds of mass behind him. And I feel that way if Oregon were playing Washington. I'm sure Auburn, Alabama fans feel the same way. There's just a certain amount of respect for a large man with the football, both from a physical and just life standpoint. So we honored that gentleman. Every single play that happened and on every level of football was a potential nominee. We have a committee of 24 people in the media and sort of former players.
24 people,
absolutely.
That's cool.
Media members, ESPN, CBS, NBC, you name it. They watched 60 plays this season from Division 1, 2, and 3. Some of these plays were submitted by, you know, tiny conferences, tiny schools. So it's about the moment. It's not about, you know, a player from Florida Tech has just as good a chance as winning as a player from Florida State, something like that. And so our three finalists this season, after all the voters saw all of the plays, were Jack Allen's run. He was given the ball, lined up as a running back, the starting center for Michigan State for the Spartans against Penn State, and had a great run for a touchdown. Ufamba Kamalu, and yes, I have memorized that name. It's taken a while, but I have memorized Ufamba Kamalu, had a great scoop and almost score for Miami, a great stiff arm, and our eventual winner, Ashton Henderson from southeastern Louisiana, for an amazing effort on a scoop and score. And he came to our ceremony. It was a very real ceremony in New York at a bakery and cafe, a famous place. We had all sorts of media there. We had an amazing crystal trophy. It sort of looks like the Lombardi trophy with a slice of crystalline pie on top. It's a sight to be seen. And gave him the trophy, had a huge ceremony. It was a black tie affair. And it was an incredible feel-good moment that I'm so happy we could have and very excited for next season of the Peisman Trophy.
That is great.
That is cool.
It was so fun.
Yeah. You know, Daniel had an objection. I'm going to let him turn it over to you because I want to hear him on the record stand up for Baylor.
Yeah, Discord. Let's talk this over. Let's talk this through.
Well, I you mentioned it before. I didn't know if you were going to bring it up, but I was going to bring up, you know, why whoever won, and I didn't actually know the full, you know, behind the Peisman. I just didn't.
Sure.
I was wondering where Laquan McGowan fit into that, because it's, you know, to have a defensive play or scoop and score and all that, you know, it's going to happen. But when they design that play,
mm-hmm.
and here comes this guy who's 400 pounds, and you pass to him, I don't know, it just seems like, how does that compare
sure.
in your voting to the just the games that are just plays that are circumstantial?
Sure. It's a great question, and I think McGowan finished fourth in our voting, and we invited the three finalists. And Baylor was very enthusiastic about the award and very supportive, as a number of schools and conferences were, because we did make it clear, like, we're not making fun of these dudes. Like, we are seriously in awe because we are idiots on the internet and we want to honor them. Laquan McGowan is, 400 plus pounds, became a mostly full-time sort of H-back blocker tight end this season. And we left it in the hands of our voters to decide which they were more impressed with, a designed play or a play by happenstance. And obviously designed play is cool because it shows the versatility of the player, and the happenstance moment shows off awareness and ability to improvise in a very hectic environment. And so all of the plays were included. Laquan McGowan, I believe, week actually combined votes from two different plays, and he was still fourth place. If a player had more than one moment, we did combine votes. Okay. So it was for the player themselves. And I think the only thing we heard from people that weren't as impressed with McGowan is that he's practicing that position. Those are plays that he practices. Those are plays that it's impressive that he's able to move like that at 400 pounds and, you know, jump over a Kansas dude and catch the ball and do all sorts of things that 400 pound people should generally not be able to do. But it was just, I think if you watch the Ashton Henderson play, there's a difference between a large athlete and a large man who happens to be playing football. And I think Henderson, with the way that he sort of moved and jiggled and was giving everything he had, he was the large man, and people were just a little bit more impressed with everything he gave to that play.
Okay.
But I'm with you. I love McGowan. It's nothing against him. He is unbelievable.
Okay. Well, I was also going to make, like you cleared that up, I'd also like to clear up that while it sounds like I may be trying to defend Baylor, I absolutely hate Baylor, so let's don't let anybody think that I'm...
But you can appreciate what he does physically.
Oh, yeah. It's just, I'm just going kind of a running gag that we just don't like Baylor, so...
Oh, no, that's totally fine.
Yeah, we don't wrestle with objectivity. Daniel's Twitter handle is Baylor Sucks Ass, which I am...
That's great.
I know, I'm proud of that. So.
Leave no doubts about what part of the body Baylor sucks.
That's right. Well, I just want to leave... I just want to lodge this objection, and for next year, because if it happens to Greener to roll, I think it should be like a lifetime achievement award. But Josh Caraway is not a small man. He plays defensive end. And last year in the Texas game on Thanksgiving, he had a pick six at defensive end against Tyrone Swoops. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, everybody had a pick six against Swoops last year. Absolutely. But he ran that back. And then there in the monsoon that we were all at, we got to see Josh Caraway do a scoop and score that actually saved the game, because I don't know if we got anything close to a first down after he scored that that touchdown, and that was returned 56 yards. So just next year, if he gets a third scoop and score or a pick six as a D lineman, I just hope he at least gets acknowledged for that. I want to make that little plug for TCU and Josh Caraway.
Can I tell you something?
Go right ahead.
We're going to be releasing in 2016. We will be releasing probably in the spring, maybe summer. I'm not positive when. A Peisman watch list. And I can tell you right now, I will be making every effort. We're going to look at guys that have had previous Peisman plays on every level. There is no reason to believe Josh Caraway will not be on the Peisman watch list going in and will get attention. And TCU and the powers that be in the Horned Frog Athletic Department will absolutely be told that young Mr. Caraway will be on watch of all of us with Peisman eyes.
Okay. Now, I just want to mention this. Don't put 87 people on the watch list. Make this a real watch list.
It's going to be
qualified individuals.
It's going to be a very real watch list with gentlemen who have either once or multiple times made a Peisman-worthy play.
Okay, just because you're projected to start on the two deep in the SEC does not put you on the Davey O'Brien watch list or the Peisman watch list. That's what we're hoping for.
So. You are absolutely correct, and that's we stand with you.
All right, great. Well, Dan, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight. Thanks for your work on the Solid Verbal and SB Nation, but thanks for talking not only Oregon TCU, but for just talking college football with us, the sport that we love.
Of course, an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome, awesome. Well, for Daniel Southern, I am Jeff Mitchell. Thank you for having Dan Rubenstein with us here on the show. And we will be back to talk about, hopefully, the Big Horn Frog win over Oregon in the Alamo Bowl. Thanks a lot for listening, guys.